Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Yesterday, the Reynoldsburg School Board filed unfair labor practice charges against the teachers' unions for the district and the state. That's after voting a week ago to prepare to hire replacements if teachers give notice to strike over a proposed performance-based pay plan. The issue of merit pay is not a new one. Coming up, we're going to talk about the history of that and other issues that have plagued the profession of public school teachers. Joining us now to focus on the Reynoldsburg issues is Columbus Dispatch education reporter Charlie Boss. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So at the heart of the dispute between Reynoldsburg teachers and the school board is the issue of how they're paid, the process by which their pay rates are determined.
That's right. Under the board's initial proposal to the union, they had called for eliminating the scheduled raises, the salary.
The steps.
Right. Okay. And instead, give pay increases based on evaluations and provide bonuses, including one for $30,000 based on how teachers' school performs on a state report card or for their work beyond classroom duties. So that was the initial proposal. So both sides met earlier this month, and while there was no tentative agreement that was reached, the board says that they reached a conceptual agreement with the association, with the negotiating team for the association, where they preserved the salary schedule. It was a 3-year proposal. The first 2 years there were raises.
I think 2% or yeah, less 2%, than 2%.
Right, 2% in the first year, 1.7% in the second year. And then they would reopen for negotiations in the third year to discuss, what goes next, whether they're looking at, they would reopen in the third mm-hmm. year. And I believe in the second year they would provide bonuses based on how teachers performed on their evaluation.
Now, this was just a conceptual agreement, though. There was nothing inked out on it.
Right. And so that was kind of at the heart of the unfair labor practice that the school board charged against the association.
Because since then, what has the teachers union done?
Well, since then, the claim is that the negotiating team walked away after reaching this conceptual agreement. And the union said, we don't have a tentative agreement. There's nothing in stone. And it just happened that occurred during that board meeting or that negotiating session earlier in the month. And, days following that, that's when the union met, the negotiating team met with the union in there. They decided to give the leadership the authority to file a 10-day strike notice if they deemed it necessary.
Now, that's just a power to file a strike notice. There is no strike. They haven't filed the 10-day notice or anything like that.
That's right.
Why are school boards and locals around the state watching this so closely?
Because the proposal, the contract proposal, is so unique. No one has done quite like what Reynoldsburg is proposing in, providing raises or bonuses based on, raises based on how teachers have been based on teachers' evaluation, pardon me. Previous rallies that the association has held prior to board meetings, there are members of the OEA who have spoken out about how, the rest of the state is watching. And I should also note that members from other teacher unions have showed up as, a sign of support and solidarity.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with education reporter Charlie Boss. She reports for the Columbus Dispatch and has been covering the dispute in the Reynoldsburg School District between teachers and the school board over merit pay, basically is what the catchphrase is for it. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Coming up, we're going to be talking to the author of a new book. It's called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. We'll be looking back over time at the culture of our relationship as taxpayers with the public school teachers who teach our children and have for many, many generations now. 614-292-8513, though, is the number to call if you have a question or comment now. How has the community responded to this conflict?
There has been a parent group that has gaining momentum who feel that, you know, who object to the use of merit pay, that, you know, there is an online petition with more than 500 signatures that are essentially calling on, you know, one very critical about the use of merit pay is, and also there are concerns about, you know, there's a new teacher evaluation system. There are new state assessments that are being used to, you know, that would be used to measure how well teachers are growing students.
And so already.
Right. And mm-hmm. so there's these questions about these new, you know, is this, does it make sense to do this when there's so many new things at play? And, you know, this parent group, which have also been at the board meetings and in support of the teachers, you know, have been very vocal about, you know, to the board. They've been sending letters. They've been on social media. Go ahead.
Well, no, that's okay. I just was wondering if the board is doing this. Was this a mandate of theirs? Did they run on this when they were running for school board? Where is it coming from that they're doing this then, if the public support is being thrown behind the teachers?
Well, the district has said that they have been moving in this direction for years. They have done pilot programs to work with, you know, with teachers who have volunteered to, you know, to do this. And so, you know, in fact, about 10 years ago, they implemented a student, they've been taking baby steps like as early as 10 years ago, and they implemented a student
evaluation
incentive award.
Okay.
Like, so, you know, teachers can voluntary sign up or, you know, create, teachers could voluntary, sign up for, or make a, create a, what is it, a proposal, or not a proposal, sorry, I'm just
That's okay.
struggling to articulate today. No, but essentially the teachers can volunteer to receive an incentive award based on how they've demonstrated growth among their students.
Okay.
And at that time, it was, I think, $2,000 they would get, and it was a one-time bonus.
Well, who wouldn't volunteer to do that? I don't get it. What were they trying to show by having a voluntary program like that?
Well, it was the district's way, or the board's way, of saying, you know, we want to recognize teachers who have done great work.
Uh-huh.
And that's the that's the reason why they have been, why they feel so strongly about this proposal, is that they feel this is a way to recognize, attract, and retain good, excellent teachers.
And then the teachers oppose it. Why?
They don't, you know, there are some questions, again, going back to the new evaluation system, mm-hmm. you know, the new assessments.
This is bad timing for this.
Well, it just, there's, you know, there puts a lot of pressure on, you know, the students. And is this really a fair way to, you know, a fair way to provide a rate? You know, there's just so many things at play based on, you know, how students do on this one mm-hmm. assessment. I mean, there's deep concerns about the evaluation, you know, the evaluation tools, you know, these new assessments that are coming in.
Is this school board driven, or is it administration driven, or is that the same thing?
It's essentially the same thing. I know that, you know, the board has felt so strongly about it. And even at the last meeting there was, you know, a board member who spoke out about why she felt so strongly about this. It was, again, because she feels strongly that excellent teachers should be paid more than fair teachers. You know, and you know, since, like I said, 10 years ago, that they have been taking baby steps toward this. Mm-hmm. This is kind of a direction that they've been going.
And is there any organization, public community organization that's supporting the school board, like they are the teachers?
Not that I'm aware of.
Uh-huh. And what's happens next? So they've come up with this sort of hybrid in concept. Now they're saying that the teachers have reneged on that, even the conceptual agreement, and they're back at square one?
Well, they have, they're going back to the bargaining table on mm-hmm. September 5th. And so, you know, we'll have to wait and see what comes from there.
What happens in the classrooms during times like this?
Well, we spent the first day of school at some of the buildings mm-hmm. and, you know, the teachers have been very adamant that, you know, what happens in the classroom, you know, they want to focus on their students in the classroom. And from what we had observed, you know, it was just like a regular first day of school. Mm-hmm. The only thing you could tell that there was anything going on in terms of negotiations, there were some teachers that wore buttons that said, "I stand with my REA." But for the most part, the association spokesperson has said that they want to keep negotiations out of the classroom.
Are there any teachers that support the school board in this issue that you've been able to find?
I have not. I haven't, but, you know, that's not to say there aren't there. I haven't, you know, talked to any or heard from any.
If the school board achieves in taking another baby step in this direction through these negotiations, is that seen as it's a slippery slope? Why are other people worried that this could occur in other districts?
There is some thought to that. Yes, that if this happens in Reynoldsburg, then it could happen in other districts because they're kind of, you know, they're...
Is it supposed to save money?
No. The district leaders have said that this is not a way to save money, just a way to attract and retain excellent teachers.
Uh-huh. Has Reynoldsburg had trouble attracting and retaining good teachers?
Well, here's the thing. Because of what's been going, well, just this year, I should say, the district has seen a large turnover in teachers. You know, the union has said that it's because of the state of contract talks, you know, and certainly, you know, when you look at, I think the year before, if I remember when we wrote about this mm-hmm. earlier, I think since August, maybe 50 teachers have left, and I believe that number has grown. In the same time period last year, I think it was 28, have resigned. These mm-hmm. are just resignations. So it would seem to indicate that there is some, you know, that teachers are leaving. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as far as how much of those are leaving because of the contract talks or because there are other opportunities or moving away with family,
Otherwise, until this year, it's been pretty typical turnover.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, Charlie Boss, I'm sure we'll be talking to you again as we consider this topic in the future. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Charlie Boss, she's education reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Coming up, we're going to hear from the author of a new book. It's called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A recent survey of American teachers found that between 2008 and 2012, the proportion of those who reported being very satisfied with their current job dropped from 62 to 39%. That's the lowest level in a quarter century. The trend is spurred in part by how the rest of us view their work and how teachers' work has been an ongoing topic of conversation for more than a decade now. Compensation, tenure, vacation time, work hours, productivity, achievement in the classroom. In Reynoldsburg, we were talking earlier, teachers now are pitched against an administration and school board that wants to replace their step compensation to one of merit. Few professions are as scrutinized as that of the teaching profession. Journalist Dana Goldstein, the daughter and granddaughter of teachers, has studied the trends and looked back in time at other similar trends for teachers. Her new book is called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. She joins us now by phone from New York. Dana Goldstein, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I quoted that MetLife survey statistics from the introduction of your book where you explain what inspired you to write it in the first place. And you said that you had assumed that the current trend was isolated, sparked by the anxieties of the Great Recession, but that was not the case.
No, actually, we've been arguing about teachers since the early 19th century in America. A lot of people don't realize that in 1800, 90% of teachers were male. And there was a whole kind of campaign to paint these male teachers back then as alcoholics, as people who beat children, and a lot of really negative rhetoric even back then about teachers. And then when we saw the transition of teaching to a female profession, we saw a lot of hand-wringing around the turn of the century, around 1900, about whether female teachers were intelligent enough to be doing the job. And today we argue about things like how teachers get paid and whether teacher tenure is a fair system. So truly, we've been arguing about this profession for 200 years.
As a culture, we seem to have this love-hate relationship with our teachers. We say that some of them perform miracles. Everybody has a favorite teacher. It's sort of like our Congress, I guess, everybody but mine. But we resent those who make a good living. There's, I say we kind of euphemistically as a society that we argue about what they make and that sort of a thing. Is there something at the root of our culture that goes to this conflicting relationship with teachers?
That's a great question. I do think there's something in American culture that speaks to this, and that is the fact that we have always had very high expectations for public school teachers. We expect them, in short, to close socioeconomic gaps. We expect them to fight poverty. And as we know in this country, we have not a very strong social safety net. So this is a very high expectation we're putting on teachers to fight poverty. And oftentimes, when they sort of failed to do this and achievement gaps persist, we get mad. And I think we're right to hold teachers to high expectations. The question I ask is, historically and today, are we giving them the support they need to do the job we're asking them to do?
You mentioned that in other cultures, teachers are neither put on a pedestal nor diminished with the American idea that if you can't do, teach.
Yeah, it's true. One of the things that really struck me is that in Finland, if you ask both men and women, what's the ideal profession for a spouse? A lot of people say teacher. And that is so surprising because here you might say doctor or, you know, high paid lawyer. And, you know, it's just really quite different.
What do you make of that? Why is it?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with how much American teachers get paid in comparison to other professions. So you mentioned teacher pay. A lot of people don't realize that the median income for an American teacher is about $52,000 per year. And this is not as much as we would think that it is. And it's important to make the point that when you look at teacher salaries in other countries, it's not necessarily that the raw salary is so much higher abroad, but there are fewer gaps between what teachers earn in other countries and what other professions earn. So, for example, in South Korea, a public school teacher earns about as much as an engineer. And in the United States, the median engineer makes a lot more than a teacher. So, in our economy, when people are considering what job to do, there's a lot of incentive to choose something else.
And that's $52,000, I think you said around 52 median in the United States, after pretty much most of them get master's degrees now or have to at a certain point, right?
Yeah, that's right. And secondary grades, certainly most do have master's degrees.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Dana Goldstein. She's the author of a new book. It's called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Dorian, who writes, generally, parents and community members are misinformed about the elements of merit pay, performance-based pay, etc. What is it about the teaching profession that makes it think that it is exempt from productivity standards that other industries have already adopted, pay being linked to performance? Why is this a bad thing? So let's talk about the issue of merit pay and how far back it goes, because this conflict over merit pay is not new.
That's right. In the book, I talk about the movement dating from about 1915 through the 1930s to pay teachers in the United States based on student test scores. So this is way back then, and again, we see a rebirth of this movement today. Interestingly, it was also tried in the 1960s. It was also tried in the 1980s. So even though this has never really broadly worked to advance outcomes for kids, it is something we try over and over again. And to the letter writer's point, the reason why this is so controversial and teachers resist it is not because of the idea necessarily of performance pay in terms of if I do a better job, I get paid more. It's the question of how we measure how well teachers do. And oftentimes we see that reformers are attempting to do this primarily through standardized test scores. And these are flawed measures.
According to the teachers, now perhaps Dorian would say, why is it flawed? How else would you measure?
Well, I would say that they're flawed measures, period. I mean, that's my opinion, but it's born from my research and the reporting that I've done across the country. We know that when we incentivize teachers to get paid according to standardized test scores, there's a lot of unintended consequences of that. It can narrow the curriculum in terms of test prep becomes basically the de facto curriculum of the school. It can lead to focusing less on subjects that aren't tested, like art, like music. And, you know, I think we need to have a public debate about whether these are systems that we support, not just to hold teachers accountable. What's the impact on the kids in the classroom?
You wrote that we've been arguing about how teachers should be trained, hired, paid, evaluated, and fired for two centuries, but never reach a consensus. Meanwhile, other countries have changed in a matter of a few generations how they manage these issues.
That's right. I mean, if you look at a lot of the countries that built their public school systems after World War II, Finland and South Korea are two that get discussed quite often, you'll see that they may have had a short period, maybe a decade, of strict top-down test score-driven accountability. So something like what we've had in the United States since No Child Left Behind. And then after that, they kind of look at some of the unintended consequences, like the ones I just mentioned, and they roll it back a little bit. And they begin to give teachers more autonomy in the classroom, and they begin to give principals more autonomy to decide what the curriculum should be within their schools. So I think that, you know, we may be seeing somewhat of a similar trend in the United States. Is this kind of accountability-driven moment going to be a short blip, or will it be something that we try for a while, we learn from, and then we kind of broaden out and get a bigger picture of what we need to do?
John in Blacklick, you are on the air with author Dana Goldstein. Hi, John.
Hi, Dana. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
Just wanted to quickly comment on something that your speaker had just said. She was talking about the narrowing of the curriculum because of standardized testing. I've actually been a teacher for the past 6 years, and I do have to say in the past few years, I have noticed that happening a lot within the school districts I've worked with, where we spend almost a month sometimes just teaching to how to take a test, and it really does narrow what we can cover throughout the school year. My question was, your speaker had also mentioned that in other countries, teachers do receive a better pay than they do here in America. I know as a teacher in America, we have wonderful benefits just for being a teacher and working in a public school system. Does that offset the pay that other teachers overseas earn, or is it or is it still much less than teachers overseas earn? And I'll take my answers off the air.
All right. Thank you. Thanks, John. That's a good question. I mean, benefits are a big part of what people scrutinize about teachers in the United States. Do they have similar benefit packages, say, in Finland and South Korea, as you mentioned?
Yeah, certainly across the Western world and in Asia, you see that teachers have strong benefits. But I think it's also important to point out that in other countries, things like healthcare are taken care of in national systems. It's not necessarily tied to a person's job. So we see in the United States that a lot of teacher pay is diverted toward pensions for retirement and toward extremely generous health benefits that tend to be more generous than people get in the private sector. I think that in order to sort of attract the best younger workers to the profession and to keep people in it in those years, say 20 to 35, it would make sense to divert some of that money into early career raises, in part because younger workers aren't necessarily so motivated by benefits. But, you know, benefits are part of the bargain we've made with teachers in this country. We've told them that look, this doesn't pay so well, but we're going to take care of you. And I think it would be tough to say that after doing this very tough job, that teachers don't deserve those other benefits.
Well, that's an interesting phrase, a very tough job. What is your sense from your research for the book about how Americans view the job of a teacher?
That's a really interesting question. So when you poll the sort of broad general public on how they feel about teachers, people are pretty positive, actually. They say that teachers are really well respected, almost on par with doctors, and they are often very fond of their own child's individual teachers. And yet at the political level, we have this conversation that our teachers are failing. So there's sort of a mismatch there.
Bill and Troy, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Good afternoon. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
My comment this morning is that generally, we are paid in accordance with how much society values a service we provide, whether that be a doctor, lawyer, teacher. So what does that say about our system and our outlook in accordance with what teachers are paid? That's my comment for today,
okay.
And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Dana Goldstein, you mentioned that in, say, South Korea, teachers are paid on par with engineers, where that's not the case in the United States.
Yeah, that's right. And part of it has to do with how much people like corporate lawyers and people who work in finance can make in America. I mean, we just have larger gaps here between what people of different professions can earn. But I think the point about societal and cultural respect is a really important one. One of the issues with American teaching is that it hasn't necessarily attracted the best students. So we don't necessarily have, you know, the straight A students with the high SAT scores attracted to teaching. That is not the case in other Western countries. It's a more academically elite job. And I think that does affect the sort of social perception of who teachers are.
The elitism issue is kind of lost on a lot of people because we graduate hundreds of thousands of teachers every year.
Yeah, we have hired as many as 200,000 new teachers per year in the United States in some recent years. So the demand for teachers is very high. And in fact, you know, we hire more teachers in some years than we have graduating from selective colleges. So it's not necessarily a realistic plan to say that we're only going to hire teachers from the most selective colleges because there may not be enough people there who want to teach.
Adam in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Adam. I'm sorry. Adam, you're on the air now. Okay. Maybe he's not. We'll check on that. What does high turnover mean? Does that mean we're just getting the bad apples out sooner? We were talking earlier about a school district in the central Ohio area that where the teachers are in a pretty tough fight with the school board and the administration over the idea of merit pay and so forth. One of the arguments they make is almost twice as many teachers quit this year as did last year at the same time. That's an indication that things aren't so great.
Yeah, so we see about half of all teachers do leave within the first 5 years or so.
That's a lot compared to others.
It really is. Yeah, it really is. And one of the things that is really interesting is that when we research who it is that's leaving, they tend to be weaker than the people who stay. So that's, in a way, a little bit hopeful. People are sort of self-selecting themselves out of the job. But one of the things we also see is that in low-income schools, in schools with more poor children, we see a lot of teachers leaving those places and going to suburban districts or going to schools that are considered more desirable, quote unquote. That's a really big problem. And when you ask those teachers, you know, why did you make this decision? A couple things emerge. They say that the working environment was not good at the low-income school. And what they mean by that when you delve in is they'll often say that the principal was not very good or not very supportive of teachers, didn't do anything to help teachers get better at their jobs. Or they also complain that in those schools, there's much more pressure around testing, that the pressure to increase test scores, the pressure to gear the curriculum toward test prep is highest in those locations. And so we need to look very carefully there because this this impact of the high turnover is disproportionate on poor kids.
And that has a disproportionate effect on them as well, because there's also a lot of transients among the student body.
That's right, and the children are moving a lot too and switching schools. So we have these schools in low-income neighborhoods that are basically in a constant state of turmoil, a constant state of flux. And that's a difficult environment to learn in.
How have teachers been evaluated over time? Let's go back to back when the public opinion of the majority male teachers in the country was that they were abusive and alcoholics and that kind of thing. How were they evaluated then?
I mean, back in the early 19th century, there was a huge movement to end corporal punishment. So to end spanking of kids or whipping of children or putting the dunce cap on children. And the way teachers discipline their students was something that people looked at very closely. And then by the end of the 19th century, you do see a push to evaluate teachers in stricter ways. One of them was to use student test scores. This idea emerges at that time. Some other ideas that have been tried is to go into the teacher's classroom and time how long it takes them to, say, pass out worksheets and collect them. This was called an efficiency evaluation, and it was really popular during the 1920s. During the World War II era, there were attempts to, you know, check out how patriotic teachers were. Were they kind of suffusing their lessons with a patriotic spirit that was supposed to help the United States win the war? That was quite popular for a while. And then as we come into the 70s, 80s, and today, we see a big effort to really evaluate teachers based on how much kids are learning. And there's a couple different ways to do this. You can go into the classroom. You can see how the teacher is conducting the lesson. Do the kids seem engaged? Does the teacher have sort of a goal? Is the lesson moving toward a specific goal? And then, of course, also we see the rebirth of this idea that we should be looking at kids' test scores and using that to judge teachers.
My guest is Dana Goldstein. She's the author of a new book. It's called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the history of conflict over the teaching profession in the United States. Still with us by phone from New York is Dana Goldstein. She's the author of a new book. It's called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. How does the issue of unionizations of teachers come into play in the United States?
Yeah, that's a great question. So teacher unionization was born about 1897 in the city of Chicago. And what happened is 97% of teachers back then were female. And a bunch of reformers at the time really thought this was a huge problem. They thought women were not tough enough and educated enough to be great teachers. And they wanted to reduce the female teachers' pay in order to attract more men to the profession. And what the teachers said was, you know, hey, this isn't fair. You should keep our pay what it is, or maybe even give us a raise. And then you can also, you know, when you show that you respect teachers more, more men will want to do it. And we're going to create a union to really fight this attempt. And that's how it all got started.
What is the historical importance of tenure? That is something that a lot of people, that bothers a lot of people, and I think it goes to the heart of what one of our earlier callers mentioned, you know, that in the private sector, you don't get a guaranteed job. Why is it that teachers should have it? And is it connected to unionization?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely is connected. I think the most important thing to point out is that tenure is not a guaranteed job. It's a guarantee that your employer has to hold a hearing and present evidence if they want to remove you from your job, and that's called due process. So tenure dates back to 1909, and it actually started in New Jersey. And what happened is that you saw at the time that a lot of corrupt urban politicians in particular were putting people in teaching jobs who they were connected to. So you know, the city council member's sister-in-law was going to get the job as sort of a favor, and it wasn't going to have anything to do with merit. At the time, you also saw teachers being fired because they were pregnant, because that would, you know, raise questions about their morality if they weren't married, or maybe they even were married and they were still getting fired because, you know, they didn't want the kids to see that they were pregnant. Teachers were getting fired because of their gender, because of their religion. Quakers were sometimes fired because they were, you know, against war. There was all sorts of bad reasons why teachers were getting fired at that time, and tenure was a protection against that. And it was something that both reformers and teachers supported in the early 20th century. It was going to make it more of a profession and less of something that was subject to political whims.
Because, after all, it is a government job.
Yeah, it's a government job, but they were trying to remove it from politics in particular.
Chris in Granville, you're on the air. Hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi. The speaker earlier spoke about a lot of turnover among teachers early on, and that the poor teachers were the ones who were leaving. And I was wondering, how did the author determine that those were the poor teachers? And could that same standard be applied to existing teachers? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
That's a good question. So labor economists who study the teaching profession have done a large number of studies about this, and it's something I talk about in Chapter 9 of my book, The Teacher Wars, so you can check that out. But what they found is looking at principals' evaluations of how good teachers were and also how much those teachers impacted student learning, they found that the ones who were leaving were not as good as the ones who were staying.
Chris and Galena, you're on the air. Chris, hi.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you. I'm anxious to read the book. As a former teacher in a suburb of Westerville and now currently teaching at the high school level, when I hear that merit pay is a part of what the system is looking at, I think that every teacher I've ever talked to supports some sort of accountability. But this isn't a field where we're creating a product. And you can't measure based on test scores. We don't get to pick our students. Our students come to us, and we may have a student who's learning disabled, and their test scores might not be that good. But when we see just a minimal amount of progress, we are so excited, and we see that there's growth. And when we put in all of the other elements that you spoke about, poverty and those kinds of things, it just becomes such a complex thing that a simple test score can't answer.
Yeah, it's interesting because it makes me wonder what priced the teacher who inspired me to go into journalism when I was in the third grade. How do you put a value on that? Has that ever been Dana Goldstein? Can you respond to that sort of valuation?
Yeah, and of course you can't measure all of the things that a teacher does for a child. You and the caller make a very important point on that. And we know that parents and neighborhoods and peer groups have very large impacts on how students do academically, and it's not fair to only hold the teacher accountable. However, the measures that we use to kind of come up with this estimate of the teacher's impact have gotten more sophisticated. So while we once just looked at children's raw test scores, now we're looking at their growth. So the caller mentioned how exciting it is when a child, say, who has a learning disability makes even a small gain. Mm-hmm. The most sophisticated of these new value-added measures for estimating teachers' impact would give credit for that because they're looking at how that student improves, and even a small improvement would be, you know, something that would be credited toward the teacher in a positive way. Another thing that's happening with these growth measures to make them more sophisticated is to create controls. So that a teacher with, say, many children living in poverty would not be compared to a teacher in a wealthy suburb. That would not be a fair comparison. So there are attempts to make these measures fairer. My argument is that, you know, that's very interesting from a research perspective. There's a lot that we can learn about teachers by looking at these studies. However, we do need to question incentivizing so much focus on the test score because of the issue of narrowing the curriculum.
Okay. Chris and Galena, thank you so much for that call. We're going to turn to Nicole in Westerville now. Nicole, you don't think value added is a good idea. Tell us what you mean. Hi.
My mom's been a teacher for 35 years, and my grandfather was also in the school districts. And I've heard some rumors going around that, you know, there is going to be pay based on their performance, and how at the beginning of the school year, the teachers are going to have to say like a specific percentage on how their students are going to perform for the standardized testing, and the teacher's pay is going to be based on how closely they make their mark, like how close that their students perform to the percentage
so
that they said.
They're going to have to predict what they think they'll achieve that year when it
Correct.
Comes to, okay, all right.
And if they're not close enough, then their pay will be, you know, reduced. And if even if their students do better than what they predicted, you know, their pay will be, you know, affected by that.
Yeah, so that's actually not unusual. I've seen in Denver and some other school districts around the country similar plans that ask teachers to set a goal and then measure if teachers meet the goal. I mean, I think I would go back to the point I made earlier, which is that if what you're doing is telling teachers to hit a test score goal above all else, you're going to see a lot of test prep happening in the classroom. And I think, you know, parents and the public need to debate if that's what we want our education system to be.
John in Marysville, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hello. I'm 51 years old. I have about 20 years experience in banking and finance. I have a bachelor's degree in political science and a second bachelor's degree in education from Ohio State. I've been subbing since the Great Recession hit me back in 2009, and as I mentioned, I've been a substitute teacher. I have a great passion. I'm a foster parent for over 4 years. I work in the Columbus inner city schools. What would be the first steps that you might recommend someone like myself at my age of 51, and how much the cost would be for me to get into teaching in some capacity? Do you have any suggestions on what my first, second steps would be and what the cost might be for me?
Dina Goldstein, that issue of bringing people in after first careers has been brought up before.
Yeah, so I'm not familiar with Ohio's, you know, laws
right.
about teacher certification. So,
but
I'm
in
not
general,
sure.
is it doable?
Yeah, so there are lots of programs like the Teaching Fellows programs that exist in many cities and states that do specialize in bringing teachers in mid-career. My stepdad is actually someone like that. He did the Teaching Fellows program here in New York City, and after a career as an engineer, became a science teacher, and it has worked out really well for him, and he's quite happy with that. So it is something that we're looking at more and more. And I think it's wonderful that your listener is interested in that, and I encourage him. One of the things we're also seeing is Teach for America, which was launched as a program really to bring young people, young college graduates, straight into the profession around age 22. They are more and more looking at career changers. So a third of their recruits this year are actually adults who already have some working experience.
Okay, thanks for that call. We have just a few minutes left. If you want to make that call, do it now, 614-292-8513. Dana Goldstein, is there anything different about this period we're in terms of our relationship with teachers that sets it apart? Are we at a point of no return? I mean, does something have to be done? Do we have to resolve something now? Or do you see this sort of fading into the fabric of history like the other eras?
Well, I think what's different about right now is that we really have the federal government very interested in teachers. So we saw President Obama's Race to the Top program for the first time create incentives and put a national focus, not just on the test scores of schools, so how are whole schools doing, but really at the individual teacher level in the classroom, requiring or, you know, asking states to pass laws that would evaluate teachers based on their student test scores. And I should just be clear, the states were asked to do this if they wanted to get certain federal grant monies. It's not something the Obama administration forced them to do.
Right.
But because states are so dependent on these federal dollars, we did see about two-thirds of the states respond. And that's why we see places, you know, passing these new regulations that require teachers to be evaluated and paid in new ways. And so this is quite new, and it is different from the past.
John in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
So I'm hearing that pay for performance is a bad idea because it would tend to lead to the narrowing of the curriculum for the kids. So that's what I'm hearing. And what I don't understand is why is a discussion about the assumption, I think, that goes into that, which is that all the kids aren't able to meet the standard. So if I asked your commentator here, as a teacher, if you could handpick a classroom of the brightest kids in the country, would your idea of pay for performance change? And that was my thought because, again, I feel like the assumption is that all kids aren't able to meet the standard.
I don't think that's the assumption at all, and the argument I'm making is actually quite different than what the caller says. So I'm not saying that children can't improve. They certainly can. All children can learn. All children can improve. But when you incentivize teacher pay to the test score, what you see is that test prep becomes a huge part of what the teachers spend time doing. And when you look at these standardized tests, you'll see that they're very simple. They're multiple choice. It's not necessarily the curriculum that we want our kids to have. We want them to have a richer and more rigorous and more vibrant day in school than simply preparing for these standardized tests.
How to fill the circles and that sort of thing.
Exactly. And the other point that I would make is that we can have performance pay for teachers without tying it to standardized test scores. There are so many different ways we can do that. We can reward teachers who are excellent as identified by their principals through classroom observations. We can reward teachers who are excellent as identified by peer review, by groups of teachers that, you know, evaluate one another's work. So I don't think it makes sense to keep the profession sort of as flat and undifferentiated as it has been historically, but that doesn't mean that the only option is to look so heavily at tests.
Okay. John, thank you very much for that call. And one more quick call from Eric in Grandview, maybe the final question of the hour. Hi, Eric.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Lately across the country, there's been a move to restrict teachers' unions' ability to collectively bargain in various different forms. We saw it here in Ohio with Senate Bill 5. In your estimation, what does the profession look like if this becomes more successful over the coming years?
Yeah, so this is a national trend. I think that if teachers' unions are significantly weakened, there's a few things that could happen. I think these calls for evaluating teachers more in student learning will get stronger and stronger because teachers' unions are the ones who have traditionally resisted that. And that could lead to good effects if we look at teachers' performance in a variety of ways, or, you know, my opinion is it would lead to bad effects if we only look at teachers through test scores. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that could happen. Another thing about teachers' unions is that they're quite effective at advocating for funding for schools, both for teacher salaries and for other priorities as well. So weakened teachers' unions might have the effect nationally of decreasing the tax expenditures on schools.
Okay. Thanks a lot for that call. Going forward, what is your prediction in the next 5 to 10 years? What do you expect to see from the current trends of conflict?
Well, I think teaching is going to continue to be very controversial politically, in part because we see this national movement to sort of create all these lawsuits that would declare teacher tenure illegal across the country. We saw this start in California. It's now spreading to New York, and these advocacy groups are saying they're going to do this nationwide. But I think there's a more hopeful trend, too, and that is the collaborative trend. Traditionally, American teachers have been very autonomous. They've worked in their individual classrooms and haven't had much time to collaborate with one another to share best practices. And the argument I make in the book and the reporting I do from schools around the country in the present day really suggests that when teachers work together to share their knowledge and skills with one another, when they have more time during the day to collaborate with other adults, not just to be in front of kids, this really has a great outcome for students. And my hope is that we empower teachers to work in that way, to really work together as a team.
Well, I want to thank you, Dana Goldstein, for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you so much.
Dana Goldstein, she's the author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Thanks a lot for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.